Have you ever heard something like, you should be ashamed just for being your true, authentic self? Then Teología Sin Vergüenza might be the place for you. We are queer, trans, feministas from Latin America and its diaspora who aren't ashamed of our faith or our activism. Our weekly conversations offer a space for reflection, analysis, and spiritual reclamation as we try to navigate home, faith, familia, and identity. So grab a cup of coffee, whether it's café con leche, café cubano, café de olla, tinto, chorreado, or americano. Join us for the deep dive into the lives of theologians, elders, activists, and everyday saints as we talk about decolonial faith, gender justice, sexuality, and sacred resistance. I'm your host, Reverend Sex. And for all of those who feel like you aren't enough of this or too much of that, ni de aquí, ni de allá, you belong here. Join us for shameless faith conversations about real life right now that you won't find anywhere else. You might just realize that you are a sinvergüenza too.
Axis Mundi.
It began with whispers on suburban street corners, then candles held by people pleading with their elected leaders, especially President Gotabaya Rajapaksa, to do something. For months, rising prices had crippled the country. Why? A brutal civil war had ended 10 years earlier, in 2009. This was supposed to be a time of peace and rebuilding. This crisis shouldn't have been happening. The government denied it was happening. Even as every day the suffering of the people increased, for ordinary people the most. So perhaps it wasn't surprising that it was the ordinary people in the suburbs, not the NGO activists in the capital or the politicians, who were the first to begin gathering in street corners with one another. It started timidly, but by the end, 4 months later, something impossible had happened. The increasingly autocratic Rajapaksa regime, the president who'd stoked Sinhala Buddhist nationalism and centralized his control over power, had been toppled. What began with ordinary people, others soon joined. First 6 people, the next day 50. Wave upon wave of people rising up. The students and young people, many of them unemployed because of the crisis, they had nothing to lose, time to spare, and they wanted to be a part of history. So they set up camp on the plazas downtown and they didn't leave. But so did their mothers and their grandmothers, their fathers and their grandfathers. Businessmen in suits and ties walked out of their offices and joined the protests. Rajapaksa saw the rising tide and fled the country just before the people took his palace nonviolently and threw a pool party in it. A new world had arrived. The ordinary people had danced it into being from the streets all the way into the palace of the wannabe authoritarian. Democracy would live to see another day in Sri Lanka.
Welcome to American Unexceptionalism. I'm Matthew Taylor.
And I'm Susie Hayward. This is the show where we ask what Americans can learn from those who have resisted religious nationalism and authoritarianism around the globe.
We interview scholars and activists about the strategies they used and the lessons they learned in their fight against oppressive religious regimes.
The United States is facing a very serious Christian nationalist threat to democracy. But we aren't alone in this fight. It's time to put our American exceptionalism behind us to learn how to create a future for all of us.
Today, we'll be exploring two countries in Asia, Sri Lanka and Burma, which is sometimes called Myanmar. These are two Buddhist majority countries with similar political and religious dynamics. They are both countries that were colonized several times, most recently by Great Britain. They've both experienced decades of organized and episodic inter-ethnic and inter-religious violence since gaining independence. In recent decades, both have experienced the rise of Buddhist nationalist groups that have espoused virulently anti-Muslim and anti-feminist agendas. Groups that have aligned with political and military leadership to advance an anti-democratic agenda. In the last several years, however, The parallel tracks of Sri Lanka and Myanmar appear to have diverged dramatically. In Myanmar, the military, that has long held an authoritarian chokehold on political power, staged a coup in 2021, bringing to an end the short period of top-down democratic reform. Violence has proliferated across the country. In Sri Lanka, as Susie described at the top, an authoritarian power grab by a democratically elected president was stopped by a popular uprising in 2022. As usual, we will have friends join us shortly to share their insights. But before we turn to them, I'd like to hear from someone else with significant knowledge of Buddhism and politics in Sri Lanka and Myanmar, Susie Hayward. Susie, maybe you could start by sharing your own background in these two countries. What drew you to study them?
After 9/11 and my graduation from college, where I'd majored in religion, I decided I wanted to focus especially on the intersection of religion, violence, and peace building as a scholar and practitioner. And that's when I turned to Sri Lanka. What drew my interest to that context was that it had experienced just decades of post-independence violent conflict. And the civil war in which it was engaged in at that time pitted the government, which was seen to represent the interests of the majority Sinhala Buddhist community, against a minority insurgent group that was called the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam. And they claimed to represent the largely Hindu and Christian Tamil ethnic minority. And the attempt to negotiate peace at the time, facilitated by Norway, had been stymied by opposition that was led by Buddhist monks. Meanwhile, the third biggest ethnic group in the country, the Muslims, they'd been kicked around a lot by both the Tamil Tigers and the government in the midst of the war, but they had largely never responded with their own violent campaigns.
So let me interrupt you there, Susie, because this is not, I think, how most people think about religion on the global stage. So you have Buddhist monks leading a nationalist violent movement, and you have Muslims who are adopting these kind of peaceful practices. I think a lot of people think of Buddhism as this peaceful religion and Islam as a violent religion.
Especially in the early 2000s, right?
Right. So help us understand this a little more.
Yeah, I mean, we have this very romantic image of Buddhism in the West. We think of it as an otherworldly religion. Max Weber was an influential sociologist of the early 20th century, and he described it that way himself, otherworldly, apolitical, disengaged, not concerned about mundane things, worldly things like politics. But those perceptions are orientalist in nature. They're sort of part of the Western exoticizing of Asia. And I also think sometimes these Buddhist groups in the West, they've embraced that image and that trope because it's a very positive one. It sheds them in a very good light. And so they've encouraged that idea that, yeah, Buddhism's not like those other religions, not like those violent religions. We're more philosophical and modern and peaceful. And they've used that to evangelize in the West very effectively. I mean, they've
Buddhist exceptionalism.
Yeah, they've attracted a lot of Western converts that way. And I think a lot of us, when we think of Buddhism, the figure that we most immediately think of is the Dalai Lama, who has, of course, had a commitment to nonviolence. Or some of us might know Aung San Suu Kyi from Myanmar, who won the Nobel Peace Prize for leading a nonviolent democratic resistance in 1988. So in 2013, you have Time magazine puts out an issue where they have this figure of a Burmese monk who we'll hear more about. His name is Ashin Wirathu. And it underneath it says the face of Buddhist terror. And it just was shocking to Western sensibilities. And that was part of the point. That's why they put him on the cover. But the reality is that Buddhism is like all religious traditions. It's composed of humans and all of their messiness. And if you look throughout Buddhist history and you look in different places where Buddhism is practiced, you have times when Buddhist ideas and actors have been drawn into movements of violence or state oppression. So like Zen Buddhism was used during World War II in order to bolster Japanese imperialism and practices like kamikaze suicide bombings. And you have examples of incredible Buddhist peacemakers like the Dalai Lama or Thich Nhat Hanh in Vietnam. So it's like with Christianity in the US, where we simultaneously have Christian actors and ideas and movements that seem to be aligned with violence and injustice. And at the same time, You have Christian ideas and actors who are part of the resistance and who are advocating for human rights or advocating democracy, and they're contesting each other. And then you have political power actors who are cozying up to one interpretation versus the other because it serves their interests. Same thing happens in Buddhist countries.
So, and this is so important because when we talk simplistically or think simplistically about religion, oh, religion is a force for oppression. Oh, religion is a force for liberation. It's both. Every tradition it contains the possibilities of both of those, the resources for both of those. And we're seeing the different communities access these different narratives and resources. So listeners might not be familiar with all the different schools of Buddhism, but I know what's practiced in Sri Lanka and Myanmar is largely the Theravada tradition of Buddhism. Can you tell us what is Theravada Buddhism?
Yeah. So it's again, similar to Christianity, where you have different schools like Orthodox, Catholic, Protestant, or in Islam, you have Sunni and Shia. In Buddhism, you have what generally people recognize three different schools of Buddhism, Theravada, Mahayana, and Vajrayana. Theravada is the oldest school. And their followers would argue that it aligns most closely to the original teachings and practices of Buddha. It's the primary form of Buddhism that you find in Sri Lanka and Myanmar, as well as other Southeast Asian countries like Cambodia and Thailand and Laos.
Now, I think people who are coming from an American experience can pretty easily get our heads around Christian nationalism, these narratives, the idea that a nation, in our case, the United States, has some intrinsic connection to Christianity, and therefore Christianity should be privileged by our government and our society. That narrative kind of lands and makes sense for people. What does Buddhist nationalism look like, and where does it come from? Are there historical roots to this?
I'm going to focus specifically on Sri Lanka and Myanmar. So there's been this long historical relationship between political power and institutions and religious power and institutions in these countries. Before colonialism, both countries were ruled by monarchies. And in Theravada Buddhism, you have over the centuries the development of this model of righteous kingship within the tradition. So there's no separation of religion and state in the modern sense. It's very entangled. The religious community and the political community and authorities, they hold each other accountable and they support one another. So the king, there's a title that's given to him. It's the Sangha Raja. It means the king of the Sangha. And Sangha is a really important term that we're going to hear a bunch throughout this episode. So let me just quickly define it. The Sangha, it can refer to the Buddhist community writ large, but most often, and how we'll be using it here, is to refer specifically to the monastic community, the community of monks and nuns within Buddhism. So the king, the Sangha Raja, oversees the Sangha, the monastic community, resolving disputes within it, ensuring the monks are abiding by the monastic discipline, the laws that they must follow. And the king offers patronage to the monastic community, gives them financial support. And then in return, the monastic community's practice of Buddhism and meditation and its study is believed to bring karmic benefit to not just themselves, but to those who support them, including the king. So it provides this kind of karmic divine goodness and legitimacy to the monarchy. This entanglement ensures the well-being of both the Sangha and the political order. But when the British come in, they entirely dismantle that system. They're imposing the modern idea of the separation of religion and state, the secular state. And so they do not appoint a Sangha Raja. And there's this perception and a reality as a result of this, that Buddhism is weakened. The monastic order is weakened.
So Theravada Buddhism is a tradition within Buddhism really built around monks and the centrality of these monastic communities. And in both Sri Lanka and Myanmar in the pre-modern period, the system emerged where you had a monarch, the king, who's both the patron and a kind of symbolic leader of the monks. And so that's the blending of religion and the state. But then the British come along and colonize both of these countries, and they put an end to that system. Mm-hmm. So then is it fair to say that Buddhist nationalism in Sri Lanka and Myanmar are both aimed at hearkening back to this pristine time, make Sri Lanka great again, make Myanmar great again, where there was this clear alignment between the government and the Buddhist monks and their Buddhist identity? Is that kind of what's going on here?
There's this sense that the weakness of the nation state and the weakness of Buddhism in the colonial and post-colonial context in both countries. It's one and the same. And the feeling, it's exacerbated during the colonial period by the arrival of Christian missionaries, encouraged by the British colonial authorities, and also by the migration of Muslims who were moving from British-ruled India into these countries in order to serve within the colonial administration. So there's a sense that these foreign influences are coming in and they're weakening Buddhism. And so modern nationalist Buddhist groups are attempting to save Buddhism from foreign oppression and influence. Today in contemporary Sri Lanka and Myanmar, the Buddhist nationalist groups operating there, they express a lot of those same anxieties that you hear in that colonial period, the need to protect Buddhism under threat. And they seek to define national identity and commitment based on Buddhism. In Myanmar, there's a phrase, to be Burmese is to be Buddhist, and to be Buddhist is to be Burmese. The idea is that anyone who's not Buddhist is automatically suspect. Their loyalty to the state is questioned. And in both countries, these groups have sought to make Buddhism the official state religion. So they trace the origin of their country's woes, colonialism, violence, ethnic insurgencies, to the rupture of this historic relationship between Sangha and the state.
This is all very helpful background, Susie, because I think for outside observers who are not experts in Buddhism or Southeast Asia like myself, things get very confusing very fast here. If you think back almost a decade ago, there was this genocide or attempted genocide against this ethnic group in Myanmar called the Rohingya. And Rohingya largely identify as Muslim. And so there were elements of Buddhist nationalism that were part of that. There were elements of this kind of military authoritarian state. But all of this is playing out in the aftermath of this colonial experience with these different ethnic groups kind of mashed together, with religion playing these complicated roles. And so we can't just kind of disentangle either of these countries from this long history, from religion, from ethnicity, from all the tensions that we see, and even in places like the U.S. as well. Okay, so now let's turn to our guest experts, Geetika and David. So Geetika Dharmasinghe is a Sri Lankan scholar of Buddhism at the University of Toronto, and David Mo is a Burmese Chin scholar of Christianity based at Yale University.
Geetika and David, it is wonderful to have you here with us. Thank you. Especially to you, Geetika, who I think you get an award for beaming in the farthest distance coming to us from Sri Lanka, where you're joining us right before bedtime.
David, let me bring you in first here. Can you give us a sketch of what's happening in Myanmar these days? How are things playing out? And what role is religion playing within the conflicts there?
Myanmar is the Buddhist majority country. About 70% of the people in the country practice Buddhism. Very much similar to Sri Lanka, actually. Let's begin by saying here, there is always a connection between the state and then Sangha. And even these Buddhist nationalisms in Myanmar and first emerged as the anti-colonial movement. And the state always used the Sangha and ordinary people, Buddhist people, to promote Buddhist nationalism since colonial period. And that turns into the anti-ethnic minority even after independence. So that Buddhist nationalism turned into the anti-ethnic minority that target Muslims as well as some ethnic minority Christians. So that is how the ethnic conflict emerged in the post-colonial period up to now. Kind of like that conflict really is identity-based. 1930s, there's the organization called Dokpama Asiyo, which was formed in 1930s to resist colonial period, which was formed by the Burma Buddhist majority, including Aung San Suu Kyi's father. Aung San, you know, and they call themselves as Dakin. Dakin means like master. Most of them are the university students in the 1930s. So Dokpama Asiyo's was the first and foremost organizations in the 1930s and saying that we are the organization of the community that exists to protect religion and race and our language. And we have to resist the British colonizations. And even today, this the post-colonial Buddhist nationalists still use that, saying that, look at our grandfathers and mothers, those who used the kind of dogma asiyung, and because of their movement that we gain independence from the British. That's why nationalism is important.
David, I think that point that you're making about Buddhist nationalism and how it emerged during the colonial period, developed by those who are fighting for independence from Great Britain and who are fighting for a democratic state, I think it's important because it kind of emerges as an understandable desire by the majority Bamar Buddhist community to reassert cultural and political autonomy from foreign influences. But then it very quickly metastasizes into an anti-minority force post-independence. It develops this Buddhist supremacist dimension to it. Geetika, let's turn to Sri Lanka, where there's some similar but also different dynamics during the colonial period vis-a-vis ethnicity and religion. Can you share a little bit about that?
Again, it's very similar to Myanmar or Burma. Sri Lanka has about 21 million people. Around 70% are Sinhalese Buddhist. Sinhalese is the ethnic identity. Buddhism, of course, is the religious identity. And we also have Tamils, mostly Hindu and Christian, making up about like 11%, and Muslims about 9%. But those identities became very rigid identities because of the colonial, this divide and rule. These nationalist movements has that kind of a history, or the militant Buddhist movements has a long history starting from colonial period, because the first thing happened to the Buddhists was this, they lost the state patronage. The Sinhalese Buddhists are the majority in Sri Lanka, but they often see themselves as kind of like vulnerable, a majority with the minority complex, which we call, like, as anthropologist Estate Thambaya explained. So in that sense, any threat to Sinhalese is a threat to Buddhists. Therefore, they have to safeguard Buddhism. And also they think it remains only in Sri Lanka, like Sinhalese only live in Sri Lanka, and their religion is Buddhism. So therefore, any threat to Sinhalese is a threat to Buddhism. And also they think the original teachings of Buddha exists in Sri Lanka, and we call in Sinhala Nirmala Buddha Dhamma. So any, like, they would do anything to protect it, right? So anyway, so this sense of insecurity is fueled by historical narratives and political rhetoric, and it drives Buddhist nationalism. The idea is that Sri Lanka belongs to the Sinhalese Buddhist, and they have a 2,500 years of continuous cultural history, unruptured past. And the state should work in their favor. That's the ideology. Other religious communities, of course, they can stay, but the Sinhalese Buddhists will tolerate them only if they're willing to live under this whole Sinhala Buddhist ideology. Whoever was in power, they have been used these rhetorics as a rallying cry. So this nationalism also has a lot to do with the violence. So these attacks, continuous, like we could say episodic violence, right, sharpen the sense of Tamils and Muslims as outsiders and allowed politicians to mobilize support through majoritarian nationalism. One last point I have to mention here, the perceived threats to Buddhism have shifted over time, right? Under colonial rule, the British were the main threat. And after independence, it was Tamil. Once that ended in 2009, because the Sri Lankan government militarily destroyed those who were asking a separate state, focus shifted to evangelical Christians first and then to Muslims. Right. So each government, again, I have mentioned earlier, regardless of their party, whoever in power, has used nationalism as a rallying cry, and then elevating Buddhist nationalist identity by demonizing minorities.
I think a critical point that I'm hearing is that during the colonial period, this narrative starts to arise of Buddhism being under threat as a result of these foreign influences. But over time, what those foreign influences are shifts. And sometimes it's communities within the country, sometimes it's communities outside of the country, sometimes those are collapsed. So can you say what is the Bodh Balasena? What are some of these contemporary Buddhist nationalist groups? And how are they articulating this threat to Buddhism?
You could hear the sense of like force, and they say the Bodhu is Buddhist, and then Sinhale and all, like, you know, these names, they actually have a kind of like a connotation, like they are to protect Sinhala Buddhist. When it comes to these groups, so they say when the colonizers arrived in Sri Lanka, that there's a rupture. That rupture took place, and we had they were the kingmakers in the past, but they lost that connection with the state because the democratic model made everyone equal, right? That's the rhetoric. Like, in a way, like, how do we safeguard democracy if it also facilitates the rise of extremists, right? Similar to Sri Lanka, we see in the US, I think, like Matt and you all talk about, these small ideological driven groups come into power, posing a kind of a systematic threat. So I would argue it is precisely democracy with these protections for freedom of expression and association that has enabled monks or these extremist groups, because they are numerically small, but certain kind of democratic reforms made them enter the parliament.
Can I just highlight two things that I'm hearing from Geetika and also from David that I think are very, very relevant to an American audience in terms of comparison and thinking. So one is this paradox of democracy, that democracy at the same time empowers groups, but can very easily lead to, I think the phrase you used, Geetika, was a majority with a minority complex.
If you go to Sri Lanka or you go to Myanmar, you're not going to come away with a sense that Buddhism is under threat. It is a very central part of cultural life, political life, social life. Buddha is everywhere. It, as an American, thinking about how sometimes the politics of Christian vulnerability here and Christianity is under threat, and the modern secular state is trying to destroy Christianity, and we need to defend it and protect it from progressive movements and so on. It has the same sense of, wait, really? I look around in the US and I see Christianity is very vibrant and in the public space and is a part of the democratic process. And there is a lot of Christian language in the public realm. So this idea of Christianity being under threat here strikes me as in some ways just as preposterous as the idea of Buddhism under threat in Sri Lanka and Myanmar. But it strikes to this idea of we're a majority, but we're feeling vulnerability. David, I want to turn to you now. What are some of these Buddhist nationalist groups that are operating in Myanmar? Why do they rise? What is some of their narratives and language?
You are right, Sushi. I mean, many Buddhist nationalists believe that Buddhism, even though it is a majority religion, predominant religion, they feel that it is under a threat. Particularly, it's not me as a Christian speaking this, but I just interviewed with some Buddhist people on the ground. That's how they told me. Particularly the contemporary nationalist leader, what is his name, who was featured in the Time magazine as kind of like the Buddhist hero. So he also said that, don't say that even Islam is a minority religion, we are under a threat. Because look at Pakistan, look at Middle East, Islamic religion is really violent and dominating all the countries. That's what they say. If we allow them to exist in this country, they will dominate our country. That is how these nationalists really believe it. And this is how they spread the word on social media like Facebook. The population of Islam in this country will become majority in the next few decades. That's how they believe it, like Islamophobia. What they really believe about Christianity is that it is a Western religion, because they really want to protect Buddhism as a pure Burmese religion. It's not mixed up with the Western religions. They see some Christians as kind of like pro-Westerners. That's how they see us. I'm a Christian there. This is how they see us. Even this, the military regime in Myanmar also believe their own way of democracy. They say democracy for them is like, we are not thinking about a Western way of democracy. We say we have our own way of democracy in Myanmar, they say. That is something set by the kind of like the Buddhist regime, like restricting to religious freedom and then freedom of speech and then like freeze, like assembly and protest. They say all these things are come from the Western, like from liberal democracy. They say this is not suitable for our country. Here in these countries, we have our own way of democracy. That is how they justify their dictatorship.
The term they use is discipline flourishing democracy.
That sounds properly Orwellian. Yeah, so Geetika, in 2022, there was a popular uprising in Sri Lanka against the president at the time, who was growing more and more authoritarian. So help us understand what happened in 2022. Why was it successful? Why did they manage to displace this president?
I'm very happy to talk about the Arugale, the protest movement. In 2022, a significant and unprecedented political movement emerged. It marked a turning point in the recent history of Sri Lanka. We call the Aragale movement, or the resistance and the protest. The people were able to meet, basically, as the most powerful president in Sri Lankan history to resign. So people came to streets and he had to go. Also, it's interesting, people demanded a new social contract. If you say in the past, it was like patriots and non-patriots. So during the Aragale, it's about like the elite and non-elite. It was a kind of a new social formation was emerging, and it's a new imagination also. So it was successful because it was non-violent and had broad participation from all classes, ethnicities, and religious groups. Also, I want to mention here, like the Aragale movement was spontaneous. Nobody organized, in a way. Of course, the leftist groups played a large role, like sustaining the protest, but it was spontaneous. Buddhist monks could not play a major role. Of course, some monks that was there, like led groups, attempted to push Sinhala Buddhists on the agendas, but they were small in number and largely unsuccessful. And also they gave up. So the movement was again anti-corruption, anti-nationalist, and emphasized a kind of a shared Sri Lankan identity. Or why it was successful, I think the major participation from all classes, or religious and ethnic, all different people, right?
Let me just synthesize a little bit of what I'm hearing from Geetika, because I think, again, we're trying to draw lessons for American audiences, especially from this. And I think one of the things that I really appreciated about what you emphasized about this uprising was that it brought all these different groups together around a common cause and said, we're going to stand up against this. But it was not using a nationalistic narrative, because that had already been kind of co-opted. But instead it was, hey, we're all in society together. It's spontaneous. It's led from the bottom up. It's a kind of people movement, but it's a united front against this more authoritarian turn. And I think that we desperately need that kind of a movement in the US right now. David, I think we could call what has happened in Sri Lanka, at least from the perspective of democracy, a great success, maybe a temporary success, maybe a provisional success, but a great success. I don't think we can call what is happening today in Myanmar a great success from the perspective of democracy. First, we know that there was a coup in 2021. So, David, maybe you can tell us a little bit more about the lead up to that and how that happened. And then also, I know you've been involved in some of building this pluralist coalition against this authoritarian government that is in place, the military government. And can you tell us some of what you've learned through being involved in that?
There are three main revolution movements in Myanmar after independence. The first was in 1988. That was led by the university students, and most of them are Buddhist university students, of course. And that is how Aung San Suu Kyi also became kind of like the icon of that revolution movement, and she became now the leader of anti-regime democracy movement. That is kind of like a little bit more exclusive movement among some of the Burma Buddhist university students. And the second movement was in 2007, which was exclusively led by Buddhist monks. But 2021 anti-military coup movement was very much impressive for all of us. It is inclusive in terms of religious, ethnic groups. This movement is not just about like coming from the top down. It's really coming up from the bottom up, like kind of like decentralized resistance, or some people, including my mentor James Gobo, call it, like kind of like decentralized resistance among ordinary people. In my opinion, there are three distinctive natures of this contemporary anti-coup movement. The first is, as I said, it is inter-religious solidarity. Christians, Buddhists, Muslims, Hindu, and people from other religions come together and show their solidarity with one another and resist the regime as their common enemy. That is the first distinctive nature of this movement, inter-religious solidarity and resistance. And the second is this movement, as I said, is like highly decentralized resistance. It just began in the villages. It begins among some ordinary people, those who are not politicians. And the third distinctive nature of this movement, and it is even different from the previous two movements, is that this movement is diasporic mobilizations. In 1988, we didn't see many Burmese migrants in the US, in Australia, or in England. But this 2021 coup movement, there was a lot of Burmese Americans, British American, German American, Australian, many people in other countries joined this movement, like using Facebook, using some social media. There are various ways of kind of like resistance against coup. I mean, in democratic country, you can publicly criticize the regime. But in a country like Myanmar, in China, you cannot really protest and resist in openly. It's dangerous. But it doesn't mean that you have to stop resisting, but you still can resist in the hidden way.
I want to shift to just make sure we pull out some of the kind of practical, tactical elements of the uprisings in both places. You both mentioned youth played a particularly important role in leading this, but leading in a decentralized way and in an inclusive way that reflected the pluralism of both countries. And it doesn't matter what ethnicity you are or religion you are, you're all experiencing that. And that creates a kind of solidarity that served as a glue. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. Also, Susie, it's very important here. I think like one of the main lessons is it was spontaneous. Like everyone was joining, and the artists or the leftist groups and everyone, the civil society, Buddhist monks and all of them. The main thing is like here, the youth, they took the leadership. They all felt the same grievances in a way, right? Because the economic collapse hits the kitchen. It was a life and death kind of like a time, right? Like they had to take a decision, and everyone was feeling, even if you're a soldier.
And there was shared solidarity to what David was talking about earlier with Myanmar. In Sri Lanka, you have the shared solidarity and suffering of the economic collapse and the food prices escalating and people losing their jobs. And it doesn't matter what ethnicity you are or religion you are, you're all experiencing that. And that creates a kind of solidarity that served as a glue. Is that right?
We were fortunate in a way. Like, I wouldn't say that, like, I wouldn't use the word, but the country collapsed. The material conditions were disrupted and it was destroyed. And that created a kind of a space for everyone to feel the same. I thought it's a kind of like a movie, like people realize, oh, these people were corrupt and then they were doing so many things and then we were losing everything. It was a kind of like, yeah, they realized, oh, this is the elite and now the people here.
We're not there yet, but it's a bit in the U.S., but it's a bit of a harbinger of the sort of the direction we're leading in with in terms of corruption and elitism. I noted in both places that religious clergy were present in support of the uprisings, but not in ways that you would have typically seen historically where they were at the helm or they were insisting on being at the helm, that they were playing a somewhat supportive role to the youth. And almost a deferential role to the youth, which seemed a sort of reversal of the usual power dynamics between clergy and young people or clergy and lay in both countries.
I mean, this movement is led by Gen Z and generations. In the early days of this movement, it was very impressive. But now kind of like there's a conflict between kind of like the clergy and then this the young people. I mean, in Myanmar, as we all know, it's like a hierarchical relationship. Like the older people have wisdom, more experience. And now these young people are trying to take all the leadership roles and they don't want to listen to the the elderly people. That becomes a challenge for us to rethink how we could make kind of like a reconciliation between the clerical people as well as these young people. So let me also talk a little bit about the artists and all this kind of thing. Many artists join. They sing songs and raise a lot of money here in the US as well as in other countries. And then they support people on the ground. So that is very impressive, like using their voices, their music, and their reputation, of course, their celebrity. And also another thing here, kind of like this resistance in Myanmar is symbolic. It's not always a direct confrontation, but it's also like symbolic. For example, some women use their taming. Taming is Burmese like sarong. So in Myanmar, it's like when you use this kind of taming or like the woman things, all this kind of thing in Myanmar culture, it's like, how to say, they put someone's power down.
I remember some of the symbols as well of the Buddhist alms bowl being turned upside down like it had in the Saffron Revolution. But you saw some of that during the post-coup revolution too, towards the military regime to sort of symbolize an exile from the Buddhist community.
Yeah.
David, I just want to note that maybe in Myanmar, the importance of musicians and artists and others and being able to resist the regime is undergirded by the fact that the military regime, some of the first people whom they arrested in the mass arrests after the coup were musicians and cultural figures within Myanmar, writers, authors, Sapo Kwar, like a number of musicians who were wildly popular and who had used their platform and their cultural power in the past to resist.
Yeah.
And then I also just want to note that from both of your contexts, the role of youth, I think of some of the youth-led movements in the recent past in the U.S., like the mobilization against gun violence, for example, and Black Lives Matter, too, which was a lot of young people who were leading that locally. And there's this way in which young people are able to kind of effortlessly mobilize across different kinds of divides to do that intersectional work in a way that is just exemplary. And speaking just for myself, I think sometimes I can still be stuck in thinking about the old ways of doing things. And so it's good to have that the thinking of folks who aren't stuck in old paradigms to try something innovative and new. So thank you very much for the time that you took to be with us and for sharing the stories from Sri Lanka and Myanmar.
Thank you so much. So thank you, Kitika. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Susie. Yeah. Thank you.
I think many of us would hear of the idea of democracy and Buddhist nationalism in Sri Lanka and Myanmar and think, well, that's just literally a world away from the United States. But I have just been fascinated as we've talked to David and Geetika to hear some of the resonances to the U.S. context from these places that really are so different. One idea that really caught my attention was when Geetika talked about Buddhists in Sri Lanka being a majority with a minority complex, in the sense that Buddhism is under threat and must be defended against domestic enemies, even though it's the majority tradition. Of course, Buddhism as a religion writ large doesn't have the same global or economic power as other religions, especially Christianity and Islam. And this experience of vulnerability is actually rooted in the colonial experience. But this also connects with the way that we talk about Christianity in the United States. I mean, you could say the same thing is going on here. We have a Christian majority, roughly around 62% of the population based on most recent surveys, a Christian majority that perceives itself as a minority, that acts like a minority, that has that minority complex. And there is some reality to that because Christian demographics are shifting. There's been this sharp decline. So there is this peril to the Christian majority. In fact, you could also talk about in the US that we have a white majority with a minority complex. And when those two things come together, you get these white Christian nationalists who present themselves and perceive themselves as under attack, engaged in this existential civilizational battle, and they're deathly afraid of just becoming another minority.
Yep. And this gets to the replacement theory that you often hear, the anti-Semitic replacement theories. That's why they play so well for white nationalists.
Absolutely. Right. They are going to displace us and we are going to be a minority in our country. That's the attitude.
They know what it's like to be treated as a minority in this country.
Because they've done it to others. Uh-huh. I sometimes say that majorities in a democracy are never more dangerous than when they feel their majority is slipping away, because they have this perception of a threat, but they're still the majority. They still have the ability to do something about it. And I think that is actually a lens through which we could understand MAGA, is the white majority and the Christian majority perceiving this threat and saying, we're not giving up power. We are going to entrench our power in such a way that we will never be put in that minority status.
Yeah. And then they foster division within the various minority communities or oppositional communities as well. In the same way Sri Lanka and Myanmar political leaders foster some of those ethnic and religious divisions to serve their majoritarian rule in ways that ironically mimic what the colonial authorities did in those countries. Okay. I want to reiterate the point that religious diversity and racial and ethnic diversity itself can be a powerful national identity. We've got these two competing narratives in US history. Are we a melting pot or a mixed salad of a group of many of us immigrants and indigenous communities, and we're working together on this American experiment to build a pluralist, multiracial, multi-religious democracy? Or are we a Judeo-Christian, European descended country that is based on and for those European and Christian ideas and values and those communities? The common sense argument that you sometimes hear is that multiculturalism, that the sort of pluralist vision, is not as powerful a mobilizing force, that it just doesn't appeal to that deep sense of belonging and identity. But is that really the case? Because here in Sri Lanka and Myanmar, they are showing how this diverse, plural mobilization and embrace of a national identity and struggle for a national identity based in pluralism and multi-ethnic belonging and multi-religious belonging was very powerful for them in these mobilizations. And it was celebrated. It was the sort of heart of that inter-religious and inter-ethnic solidarity that David was speaking to.
Yeah, and this is where, when you think about democracy, The tools of democracy, the rhetoric of democracy, can be used to advance a sort of majoritarian, we're the Buddhist majority, we're the Christian majority, we're the white majority, and so we get to govern. The language and tools of democracy can also push you towards the equality and dignity of everyone. All of us are in this society. We're all in this together. We all recognize and respect each other, and that's what we would sometimes talk about as pluralism. So this is why I think it's so important that we not only say we are advocating for democracy, but that we define what we mean by democracy. Because we're living in this global order that is built around the UN and this kind of post-World War II, what some people would call Pax Americana kind of world that we inhabit. Everyone around that world frames their countries as democracies or republics. So it's the People's Republic of China. And Russia pretends to be a democracy. I mean, just don't go around trying to run against Vladimir Putin in an election if you don't want to end up with radioactive poisoning. But there's still the pretense of it being a democracy. So if we're going to say we want to advocate for democracy or we believe in democracy, we need to define what we mean by that. We're talking about liberal democracy, not in this like liberal versus conservative, but in the sense of liberties and protecting the rights, the minority rights of people, protecting meaningful political competition that is not just a one-party system, protecting human rights, a reliable legal system. All these things are intrinsic to a meaningful democracy. And this is important because the very language and mechanisms of democracy can be used to undermine democracy. Look at this example that David gave in Myanmar. This dictatorship under Min Aung Hlaing and the Buddhist nationalist regime, they say, well, we have our own way of doing democracy, or what was the phrase? Discipline flourishes democracy? Is that right?
Flourishing democracy.
Discipline flourishing democracy. That's all just doublespeak. It's yes. just authoritarianism masking itself. But I spent so much time researching January 6th. The people who stormed the US Capitol on January 6th, they thought they were saving democracy. That was their rhetoric. They thought we are liberating our democracy. And as we saw last week, when we talked about Korea, this enchanted legacy of the Cold War means that this word democracy gets coded as good, and then communism or the left or Marxism gets coded as bad. But we really need to be crystal clear what we mean by democracy, because you can just as easily play around with these kind of words and turn people against the principles of democracy using the rhetoric of democracy.
Yeah. And it's also the play of majoritarian groups, right, who are trying to impose a kind of majoritarian democracy that doesn't abide minority rights and minority involvement in the political process. And what's so insidious about some of these Buddhist nationalist groups in Sri Lanka and Myanmar is the way they've not just used the language of democracy, but they've used the techniques of democracy so effectively. So David mentioned this in Myanmar. There's a group, the group Mabata, which was a monk-led Buddhist nationalist group, did some very impressive democratic mobilization in 2015 to pass a set of 4 race and religion laws that targeted Muslims and women in the country, restricting their rights. They led a petition campaign. They went across the country to various villages in order to collect signatures for their petition. They held these big assemblies. I mean, it was people power organizing par excellence. And it was successful. They passed these 4 laws. But the laws that they were passing were anti-democratic. They were passing these anti-democratic laws through these democratic civil society mobilization processes. So we have to recognize how these democratic techniques can be wielded against democracy itself. And we have to out-democratically maneuver these groups that are seeking to weaken democracy through democratic processes. And it's just a constant battle.
I mean, that's what democracy is. Democracy is vigilance. It is holding this tension in society is the act, the verb of democracy. Okay, so one thing I wanted to draw out here, Susie, because we've seen this with when we talked about Brazil and Korea, this idea of transnational ties among these religious nationalist movements. But in both those cases, we were talking about Christian nationalist networks, Christian nationalist messages and agendas and leaders crossing these boundaries and borders between modern nations. How does this work with Buddhist nationalism? Are there transnational ties among Buddhist nationalist movements, say in Sri Lanka and Myanmar? Are they connecting with other religious nationalist movements around the world?
I mean, with respect to Buddhist nationalism, co-mobilization, 100%. So you have Buddhist nationalist groups in Myanmar and Sri Lanka that at the height of their power in the mid-teens, the 2015, 2016, they're traveling back and forth constantly. They're signing memorandums of understanding between their different organizations. They're clearly mimicking each other's techniques and strategies. Now, with respect to the idea of pluralist fascism that we've talked about in earlier episodes, and alignment between Buddhist nationalist groups and other religious nationalist groups around the world. I mean, one thing you just have to remember from the start is that neither country is a great power country. They're very small on the global stage. That feeds into some of the insecurities they're experiencing. But they do look to Christian nationalist movements, particularly in the U.S., as an example. So like the Sri Lankan Buddhist nationalist group, the Buddhabala Sena, Geetika mentioned them, they had a Facebook page where they were cheering on Trump's first campaign. So there's some love and admiration that's being expressed. Certainly the Buddhist nationalist groups are repurposing some of the Islamophobic language of Christian nationalist groups and some of the anti-feminist language. It doesn't necessarily go both ways, though, because with a transactional Trump administration, what are you going to get out of Sri Lanka and Myanmar? Not much. And so it's a bit of an unrequited love. And I should note also that it's not just the Buddhist nationalist groups. So you also have Christian groups in Myanmar that very much admire Trump and his Christian allies, this sort of strong arm, muscled Christianity, political Christianity they envy.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I see this happening all over the world with Christian nationalist groups appropriating Christian Trumpism in their context and often using some of these messages and ideas coming out of the U.S. Christian community to vindicate their worldview and to claim a certain power. So that's happening all over the place. Let's turn to the resistance movements in both countries. Obviously, Myanmar is a real warning case. Just when you move from this kind of democratic contestation, elections mode, when it moves into this real authoritarianism, kind of hardline authoritarianism that becomes entrenched, it's very, very difficult to get back into a more democratic space.
And particularly when you have an authoritarianism that is run by the military with all of their military power. I mean, I can't overstate how powerful the democratic movements in Myanmar in the past have been. The one in 1988 that was led by Aung San Suu Kyi, the one in 2007 that was led by the monastic community that's often called the Saffron Revolution. Both of those democratic movements, people power on the streets, just masses of people, all the forms of symbolic resistance and the powerful aspects of nonviolent democratic mobilization were on display in those movements. They were also very Bamar Buddhist dominated in their leadership, as David noted. So I do want to note that. That was one of their weaknesses. But they were both put down very effectively by a very brutal military regime that is not afraid to use violence against its own citizens. Similarly, the post-coup, the 2021 civil disobedience movement and the post-coup resistance in Myanmar was massive. And in this sense, it was different in that it really united the ethnic and religious groups in ways that those earlier movements hadn't done. But the military once again responds with overwhelming violence against its own people. What I take away from Myanmar is, yes, that warning, but also just so much appreciation for the Myanmar people's unwillingness to give up. It's just remarkable. And I admire the courage and the fearlessness that it takes for them to persist in these movements, to continue to rise up, knowing the costs, but yearning for the benefits that might come for this democratic system that they're fighting for. What strikes me about Myanmar every time I'm there is that they're just a deeply spiritual people. Religion plays such an important part of the ways in which they've survived under authoritarianism for decades. And I think there's something about that that contributes to their resilience. Myanmar is actually, it's the birthplace of the lay insight meditation movement. That you see insight meditation centers here in the West, that comes from Myanmar. And that practice of lay meditation, insight meditation, has been used by political prisoners in order to take care of their souls. And it's become a sort of tool for the resistors of authoritarianism, for them staying groundly and spiritually sustained in the midst of this long struggle that they've been a part of. So they integrate that kind of spiritual practice for the long haul. And then it's the religious institutions and networks that have provided the mutual aid to poor communities or the displaced populations during political violence when the state has failed to do so. So through religious practices, through religious institutions, they've created this quiet, underground resistance network and system that has been resilient over decades. David mentioned that, the hidden resistance methods. If we think about particular lessons for our own context in the US, that's what Myanmar can offer us, is how to create these underground systems and draw on spiritual practices in order to sustain ourselves for the long haul.
Yeah, and I for one, deeply hope that we in the United States do not reach a status quo like what we see in Myanmar, but we should be building these resilient networks now to try to intervene in that case. But meanwhile, Sri Lanka, I mean, what an inspiring story. I mean, Geetika laid out this kind of resistance movement that we've seen there. I just want to pull out a few of the things that have really worked there that she was noting, because I think these are very relevant for our kind of American case, right? One, it was nonviolent. It was kind of avowedly nonviolent, even in the face of this kind of authoritarian government. It was broad-based, right? You had people from different ethnicities, different religions, different social classes, but it was truly instigated by ordinary people. It began in the suburbs.
To imagine a resistance movement beginning in the suburbs, but yeah.
And they were using this theme of anti-corruption that unites people against the regime, because the regime wants to be corrupt and then divide everyone else so they can kind of keep making money and power more theirs. But the more we can focus on that corruption, that kind of speaks to everyone. The resistance was patriotic, but also anti-nationalist, right? We're all in this together. We're all equal. We're all part of this country. And it was led by young people with clergy and other folks supporting, right? The rising generation were the ones kind of driving the action. That all just seems so spot on for what can be really applicable to our U.S. situation.
Yeah. And one thing I want to underscore is that the president who was overthrown, Gotabaya Rajapaksa, he, just a few years earlier, he'd been considered a national hero. He had led the army that had defeated the Tamil Tigers after a 26-year civil war. And his president, Mahinda Rajapaksa, was the president at the time. So this Rajapaksa family and regime was just considered omnipotent. They were heroes, especially to the Sinhala Buddhist community for what they'd done. But in just a few short years, because of the economic crisis and the shared suffering that all people, regardless of their ethnic and religious background, were experiencing, this rising up showed that, no, Gotabaya and the Rajapakshas, they're not omnipotent. And so my Sri Lankan friends, they look at what's happening here in the U.S., and they see a lot of similarities between Gota and Trump and the hold on power. They say, look, it's not omnipotent. Yeah, he might have this hero status that seems impenetrable. There's nothing wrong that he can do, and he's still going to be considered a hero by some of his constituencies. But if things continue the way it is, that's sort of inevitable. As healthcare prices go up, as food prices continue to go up, and so on and so forth, it's just going to create more suffering for all people. And that omnipotence might start to crumble. That perception of omnipotence might begin to crumble in his hero status. And therein lies the seeds for a U.S. Aragaila, an uprising.
Yeah, and we sometimes forget, if we've only lived within more democratic spaces, that authoritarian states also have politics, mm-hmm. right? And authoritarians need to protect their own reputation because they're fragile. You mentioned something in going back and forth with David that I want to come back to. It was just in passing. It was about the monks turning over their alms bowls.
Yeah, it's a really cool example.
Can you elaborate on what that was about?
Yeah, I'm happy to, Matt. This is a core practice in Theravada Buddhism. Each morning, monastics go door to door in villages with their alms bowls to receive the food that they will eat for the day. And the lay people give the food to them. And in return, they receive karmic benefit that helps them gain a better rebirth. So when a monk or a nun turns over the alms bowl, it denies lay people the ability to participate in this daily ritual act, and so the ability to benefit karmically from them. It's an act that is essentially exiling that person from Buddhist ritual life. And in the context of the resistance, the monastics are doing this to the military leaders. So it's an act of condemnation. But in that context, it's also denying them the Buddhist legitimacy that they claim. And David also mentioned the way women use their sarongs or skirts as a symbolic resistance. Let me explain that quickly because it's another really cool example. In Myanmar cultural belief, women's sarongs are believed to like zap men's powers to be ritually impure. It's a pretty misogynistic belief, honestly. But the women are using it here to their advantage. So they would hang their skirts on clotheslines in the entryway to their community streets. And the male security forces wouldn't want to walk under the skirts because of their belief that this would somehow emasculate them. The women also hung their skirts over the photos of military leaders and Buddhist monks who were aligned with them. So the use of skirts, the alms bowls being turned over, these are just a couple examples of the powerful and creative symbolic resistance used in Myanmar protests.
That is powerful. Like that, the religious symbolism is really powerful, and it carries a different political weight. We've talked about this in some of our previous episodes, right? That it's really important to have religious voices and religious leaders from the same religion as this religious nationalist movement leading the resistance. So if it's a Buddhist nationalist movement, it's good to have Christian and Muslim leaders and voices like David's out there, but Buddhist monks have more power to speak to their own community. I had the privilege of getting to know Jim Wallace. That might be a name that some folks recognize, a kind of old school evangelical left activist organizer. He's been kind of something of a mentor and a friend to me. And I was talking to him this summer about some of these protests we were seeing in the streets. And Jim said this thing that really, really struck something with me. And he said, no one's going to like how this sounds, but our Christian clergy in the U.S. need to paint a target on their backs. Because faith leaders carry a weight and a power in society. And it's one thing for the Trump administration to go and try to take down the big fancy law firms or the universities because everyone kind of resents them. But faith leaders are popular and respected in a different way. And this was before we started to see some of this image in footage of like David Black being a Presbyterian pastor in Chicago who's been on the front lines of some of the anti-ICE protests. But other clergy as well, getting shot with pepper spray.
Jorge Bautista, UCC Latino clergyman in Oakland, same thing.
We need more of that. Part of the power of the civil rights movement was that it was largely led by faith leaders, not just black clergy either. There were a lot of white Protestant and Catholic ministers who got involved, and a whole cohort of really brave rabbis were also involved in the civil rights movement.
Yeah, Abraham Heschel.
Absolutely. So, my Christian leaders out there, I want to speak to you. Anyone in the sound of my voice, that's an old revival preacher saying, anyone in the sound of my voice, preachers, pastors, please paint a target on your back. Get on the front lines. Wear your clerical robes and stoles and all the doodads that make you look like an official religious leader. Get out there and help lead us. That might put you in some hot water in your congregation. That might make your denomination wince and squawk. That might mean you get shot with a pepper ball or roughed up by ICE. But I ask you, picture the protests. Picture the whole scene. Where would Jesus be? Thank you to Geetika and David for helping us understand these very, very important examples. Next week, we will be going across the Indian Ocean to India. And we'll get to explore Hindu nationalism with some excellent experts. So come back next week.
That's it for this episode of American Unexceptionalism. Thanks for joining us.
Please hit subscribe and give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts.
You can keep up with this show and all the other great series from Axis Mundi Media at www.axismundi.us.
This show is produced by Andrew Gill and engineered by Scott Okamoto. Funding provided by the Institute for Islamic, Christian, and Jewish Studies, Princeton Theological Seminary, and the International Center on Religion and Diplomacy.
Until next time, remember, the struggle for democracy is global, and we aren't alone.
Have you ever heard something like, you should be ashamed just for being your true, authentic self? Then Teología Sin Vergüenza might be the place for you. We are queer, trans, feministas from Latin America and its diaspora who aren't ashamed of our faith or our activism. Our weekly conversations offer a space for reflection, analysis, and spiritual reclamation as we try to navigate home, faith, familia, and identity. So grab a cup of coffee, whether it's café con leche, café cubano, café de olla, tinto, chorreado, or americano. Join us for the deep dive into the lives of theologians, elders, activists, and everyday saints as we talk about decolonial faith, gender justice, sexuality, and sacred resistance. I'm your host, Reverend Sex. And for all of those who feel like you aren't enough of this or too much of that, ni de aquí, ni de allá, you belong here. Join us for shameless faith conversations about real life right now that you won't find anywhere else. You might just realize that you are a sinvergüenza too.